You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Monster House presents.
You can enjoy extended commercial-free versions of this show by joining us at patreon.com/monstertalk, all one word, M-O-N-S-T-E-R-T-A-L-K. For as little as $2 a month, you can enjoy longer interviews, unbleeped language, and bonus episodes exclusive for patrons. And if $2 a month is not workable for you, but you still want to help out, be sure and leave us a positive review on your podcasting platform of choice. iTunes reviews in particular can help bring in new listeners, and your positive reviews really make a difference. If you want to learn other ways to help out, visit monstertalk.org/support, where you can find even more ways to help keep this show going. Thank you to all of you who are supporting us with your hard-earned money and valuable time. We are humbled and grateful and hope that we always live up to or even exceed your expectations. Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as Food with Mark Bittman, Big Picture Science, and Fork in the Road. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com.
The manager of the National Theater in Westwood says that there indeed are at least a dozen people who faint or become ill during every showing. But The Exorcist is still drawing sellout houses for every performance, complete with lines around the block. I spent an evening in the lobby just to see if people really do come stumbling out in the middle of the picture, as reported. They did, so I asked them why.
It just scared me to death. Things just like this just really scare me to death.
Are you going to go back in and see more of the movie now?
Probably, yeah.
I fainted like 10 minutes after the first beginning of the movie. And I walked out, and they gave me some water.
I don't know why I waited 4 hours to see that.
The fact that people do wait 4 hours in line and then go back in to see more after they've fainted or gotten sick, I guess it shows how far some people will go for the thrill of being chilled to the bone. And judging from my long night in the lobby, the people most susceptible to being profoundly upset by the film are those who went in believing in the devil, Roman Catholics especially.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stoltzner.
If you've been paying attention, there's been an emerging theme in Monster Talk that keeps popping up, and it's simply this: that fictional media affects how people interact in reality. I think we started talking about this through the somewhat tongue-in-cheek term scripteds, which refers to the effect that films have on how people perceive monsters. Some classic examples include the possibility that the film King Kong's depiction of sauropods may have influenced early Nessie sightings, and it may be that the first sightings of the chupacabra were influenced by the film's species. And there's evidence that Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Communion may have influenced how sincere people experience what they call alien abduction. The point is that the imaginary is something that can be shared, and when it is, the recipient mind is not immune to influence. What we consume shapes what we experience. In their new book, The Exorcist Effect, authors Joe Laycock and Eric Harrelson tackle this fascinating feedback loop using the 1973 film The Exorcist as the starting node, and they follow the way that the fictional film used many clever tricks to feel more realistic, and how the real world began quickly to incorporate fictional elements of the film into the modern practice of exorcism. I'll put a link to the book in the show notes, and if you're in the Austin area, pay attention after this interview, and we'll tell you where you can go and meet Joe and Eric and get signed copies in mid-December. Or if you're impatient, you can check the show notes now.
Monster Talk.
So let's start with Joe. Welcome back, Joe Laycock.
Hi, Joe.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me back. My name is Joseph Laycock. I am an associate professor of religious studies at Texas State University.
And newcomer to the show, Eric.
So my name is Eric Harrelson. I am the preservation and conservation librarian at Miami of Ohio.
Oh, really?
Great.
Okay. Well, yep. You're at a university where I have a colleague, Jeb Card, teaches archaeology.
I have met Jeb Card.
Oh, there you go. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Through Joe. There you go. All right, cool. Well, we're here today to talk about your new book, The Exorcist Effect, and really highly recommend this book. I know sometimes people people think that, you know, we're just here to advertise books. That, you know, that's not true. But wow, this one covers a lot of material.
The ones we like.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I don't think we've ever recommended a book that we didn't enjoy. So I do feel very comfortable saying that. But this one dives deep. This one's got some – it's simultaneously academic and salacious.
And very accessible and readable.
Yes, quite. So I really enjoyed that. But maybe I don't know how you would want to split this question up, but what's this book about?
You know, there was a book that came out in about 2001 called American Exorcism by Michael Cuneo, and his big thesis was, you know, exorcism was not normal. It was almost unheard of until the movie The Exorcist came out in 1973, and now exorcism has taken off. It's become kind of mainstream. Well, that was 20 years ago. That was well before the Conjuring movies and the rise of the International Association of Exorcists and Russell Crowe playing Gabriel Amorth in this wild film that came out earlier this year. So we felt it was partly true that modern exorcism was taking its cue from horror movies like The Exorcist. But there's a second side to this, right, which is that the revival of exorcism is inspiring more movies. And so the name The Exorcist Effect refers to a kind of Mobius strip or a loop, right, in which horror and religion are kind of shaping each other. So this book is trying to map out that process.
To expand a little bit on what Joe said as well, we kind of felt that the characters and the real life people of Ed and Lorraine Warren sort of perfectly illustrate our premise in that they rose to sort of national notoriety through the Amityville Horror, being loosely associated with the Amityville Horror and a few of their other cases. They always drove really hard to try to have movies made from what they had done. And now their lives have been turned into movies through the Conjuring franchise. So we felt that there was they sort of illustrated what we were trying to get across.
And I think we're going to get into that topic shortly. But along the way, why did you guys decide to write this book?
Well, I teach a class on exorcism and demonology at Texas State because this is one way to get students to sign up for a religious studies class and help build the major. And I got approached to write something for an online magazine called The Conversation. And when that came out, I got approached by Penguin to write what eventually became the Penguin Book of Exorcisms. And then I got approached by another publisher who just said, can you pitch us something about exorcism, right? Exorcism is hot right now. And generally, when people ask me to write a book, I want to say yes, but I was frankly overwhelmed. I had like two other books under contract. And so that's why I tapped Eric. That's one reason why I tapped Eric, is because I needed help. But also, Eric has a background in film and is super knowledgeable about horror, especially. So he agreed to team up with me and write this book.
Yeah, Joe and I had actually we met and had worked together briefly when I lived in Austin, Texas. I programmed for a film festival called Other Worlds, and through that. That relationship, I did an interview with Joe about one of the films we were screening. It was, I believe it was something about demon summoning. I can't remember exactly which movie it was at this moment, but we worked together on that. And so when Joe was approached with this book, he approached me and said, you know, could you, you know, help me with the sort of film aspect of this? And, you know, I said, yeah, I'd love to.
A big concept that comes up a bunch of times in the book and is something we talked about on the show a lot is this idea of ostension. Now, I'd like to talk about it in terms of like the most basic meaning, but there's also a few variants that you guys discuss. And so can we talk a little bit about maybe what it is, how it manifests, and briefly why it is?
Yeah, so ostension is a concept that comes from folklore studies, which unfortunately is kind of a dead discipline at universities. But the idea is that narratives and stories actually create action. So we normally think of this as the other way around. A story must be describing something that happened in the past. And in fact, we know that it works the other way, too. Telling a story causes things to truly occur. A really obvious example of this would be the urban legend that people poison candy on Halloween. As far as we know, nobody actually really did that until this man in Houston had this idea to murder his son with a poisoned pixie stick and thought, I'll get away with it because everybody knows this urban legend. So the legend became real. Here in Austin, where we started writing this book, Mark Kilroy was a UT student who was murdered over spring break. By Adolfo Constanzo, who was sort of working for a drug cartel and was doing this kind of idiosyncratic form of basically folk magic, which involved a human sacrifice. And then later it was learned that Constanzo was obsessed with this horror movie called The Believers. And so this kind of somewhat racist horror movie depicting this ridiculous version of Santeria, which is a real religion, came to life and contributed to an actual murder. So this is the concept of ostension. And then Bill Ellis, who's a folklorist, has kind of broken this up into different categories. So in the cases I just described, the story is literally coming to life. But sometimes it's something like you interpret evidence in light of a story you've heard. So for example, you find a dead cow and you conclude this must be the work of a satanic cult. Or people simply lie. There is no actual experience, but they either have a false memory or they simply invent a story based on some other story that they've encountered somewhere else. So there's a lot of ways that we know that a fictional story can kind of take on a life of its own, and we call this ostension.
In your book, you talk about or use a term, the unholy trinity. What are you talking about when you refer to the unholy trinity?
So the Unholy Trinity refers to three films that came out within a few years of each other. So you had Rosemary's Baby in 1968, and that's considered 1968 is considered a really important year for horror because you had Rosemary's Baby and Night of the Living Dead. And these were two films that kind of showed horror was serious. It wasn't just something to kind of make out to at a drive-thru or something like that. And then in 1973, you got The Exorcist. And in 1976, you got The Omen. So these films are often described by, you know, film buffs and historians as being kind of a family or a trinity of satanic movies.
Sure.
And the, you know, one of the reasons why those three movies in particular stick out is because they ground the supernatural in a very mundane situation, a very everyday world. You know, Rosemary's Baby being the apartment complex, and the nice old couple. You know, The Exorcist being you know, just a young woman in a, you know, in an apartment, and you know, The Omen being you know, being a mix up at the hospital. Like it are very real and how do I put this, like I said, grounded and real story. So people,
but yeah, plausible,
latched on to that. Yeah, plausible. There you go. Thank you.
Yeah, and in fact, critics of Rosemary's Baby, the first of these films, said, you know, where's the thunderstorms? Where's the haunted castle? Where's the Transylvanian accents? This isn't believable. Witches are not real. But it's now, you know, pretty much recognized that that film contributed directly to Satanic Panic and the idea that your kind neighbor could be a Satanist.
And the haunted castle was the producer. Boom! What?
Yeah,
That is a great. I love all of those movies. So, Rosemary's Baby is 68, right? And so I got a chance to go to New York City for work. I think it was 2015. Doesn't really matter what year it was, but you know, in my big tour of New York City, the places I wanted to see were, you know, the Empire State Building, the Statue of Liberty, and the apartment building where Rosemary's Baby is shot. And, you know, it's like right there. It's like just a couple of blocks from the Ghostbusters building. It's like there's a really wonderful sort of paranormal adjacent to a Central Park. And it's such a low-key movie, and yet it's so powerful and so well shot. But it as important as it is, I think – it's kind of overshadowed by how powerful The Exorcist is. So in the book, you guys really lay out the way now, in one sense, I want to say it's the way the media responded. But in another sense, it's like how the whole public of America responded to The Exorcist. It didn't have any sort of cultural precedent, did it? I mean, there was no sort of preceding film that had this big of an impact in how people performed or reacted or responded spiritually and theologically. I can't think of any film that has as big of a cultural footprint in the spiritual realm as The Exorcist.
Yeah, I mean, for folks who don't know, when The Exorcist came out, when it was in theaters, there were lines that would start at 8 a.m. And went around the block. And we found that William Peter Blatty, who wrote the novel, and William Friedkin, the director, would like bring coffee to people waiting in line for hours. We found one report where the theater canceled the last showing and there was a riot because people had been waiting in the cold for so long. And then when people saw the movie, they were fainting. They were vomiting. We found one case where somebody sued because he said, I fainted and I cracked my tooth on the seat of the theater. And it's your fault for putting subliminal messages in the film. And there were even people who went straight to basically mental hospitals after watching the film. And there are psychiatric journals describing this new form of neurosis associated with this film. And some of this is exaggerated, but some of this, I think, is definitely real. You know, we have names of people and sort of descriptions of their therapy after seeing the film. And even at the time, people realized this seems to be kind of a self-perpetuating cycle, right? You're primed to have this experience when you go to the movie. Everybody has been talking about it. And so that kind of prepares people to react in certain ways. But looking for another film that inspired this kind of reaction, it's hard to find. You know, there are reports of the original, like, Universal Frankenstein having, you know, a nurse on hand or something like that, if in case people fainted. But really nothing like this scale that am I aware of.
You know,
we had the matinee shock advertisement trying to elicit these types of reactions, you know, trying to say that their film was going to scare you so much. But it really is difficult to find something that sort of organically arose the way that The Exorcist did.
Yeah, I mean, in the modern world, we have these sort of media machines that sort of prop up this, you know, all the sort of extra textual, you know, media articles about, you know, various concepts. So a movie might come out and there'll be a bunch of articles about the topic. But this is a movie where the movie came out and the articles weren't about the topic as much as the incredible response, the physical responses that people were having in the auditoriums, like, you know, people having physical responses, people feeling the compulsion to have an exorcism performed to get the evil out of them. I mean, it seemed like the movie tapped in a very visceral way into sort of a latent spiritual warfare narrative that I think maybe people it must have been there all along. I don't think it was all planted by the exorcism, but it sort of broke it loose in some way.
Well, one thing that I see happening here is, as someone who studies American religious history, is in 1970, this Gallup poll, they asked, do you think religion is gaining or losing influence? And in 1970, that poll basically peaked. That was the highest for the 20th century. Everybody said religion is dying. There was this very famous cover of Time in the 60s with a black cover, and in red it said, "Is God dead?" That magazine is actually in Rosemary's Baby, if you look for it, in the scene where Rosemary goes to her doctor, who is actually a Satanist. And then, of course, The Exorcist, it's red font on a black background. So all three of these movies are kind of a public conversation about what will happen once religion is dead. Will there be anybody to kind of protect us from supernatural evil? And the people who were having the biggest problems after watching The Exorcist, it wasn't ardent Christians and it wasn't atheists. It tended to be lapsed Catholics, right? People who went to church when they were a kid and stopped going. And this seemed to somehow trigger some kind of morbid fears, or at least that's how all of the reportage that we could find from this era was describing this. It's the lapsed Catholic who's having this trouble with the movie.
Well, speaking of Catholics, with the warnings that were given by the clergy before airing The Exorcist, were those genuine warnings or was that part of a marketing ploy?
Yeah, so Rosemary's Baby was condemned by the Catholic Church. They said this is a terrible, blasphemous movie. They actually said it's especially blasphemous that Rosemary's Baby was a good movie. If it had been a lousy movie, we wouldn't have been so angry about it, right? And so when William Peter Blatty wanted to do a novel about exorcism, his mentors, because he had gone to a Catholic college, Georgetown, said, well, I'm going to help you research Catholic demonology because I don't want another Rosemary's Baby. So this was intentionally meant as a kind of Catholic answer to Rosemary's Baby. But then William Friedkin was not religious. He was Jewish. And so he very quickly, especially when his movie was, you know, months and months behind budget and millions of dollars over what it was supposed to cost, began promoting this claim that the film was cursed. And Father Thomas Birmingham, who was the consultant on the film, was asked to come in and do an exorcism. He did not do an exorcism. He did a blessing. But the story was good enough. So Friedkin really milked that for all he could and told people, you know, all these terrible things have happened on the set. The set is cursed. We had to have a Catholic priest come in and bless the set. That's how bad it is. And I think that was very effective viral marketing for his film.
Sure.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinWagPod and WagOn.
If you want nightmares, you are in the right place.
I couldn't sleep last night after listening.
This podcast is genuinely scary.
That's what people are saying about Frightful. And if you'd like a few nightmares of your own, then how about you step this way? Hi, I'm Peter Laws, and I'm an author, journalist, and the host of Frightful, the podcast that is giving folks the serious creeps. From spine-tingling tales of the paranormal and shocking true crime to disturbing cults, possessions, and the forgotten horrors of history, Frightful is the podcast that pulls you into the darkness with immersive music, sound effects, and storytelling that is designed with one thing in mind: to get under your skin. With new episodes every other Sunday, you'll have plenty to keep that heart rate high. The good news is it's available free wherever you get your podcasts. The bad news is that after listening to this show, you might just have to spend a few more cents on electricity. After all, you're going to be sleeping with the lights on. So search Frightful in your podcast apps, and I will see you there in the dark.
Well, it's funny because it is marketing, but at the same time, you call it a metatextual anchoring, and you make a beautiful connection to the sort of way that H.P. Lovecraft would insert real and fictional books and various other details into his stories to try to make them seem plausible.
Yeah, so one of the things that we talk about in this book is this concept of veracity mechanisms, which was created by a scholar of new religious movements who's looking at how certain material lends itself to kind of religious views. So he's thinking of things like, Jediism, right, an actual kind of movement based on Star Wars. So he says there's certain things that a story can have that will foster this kind of real-world religious activity. And one of them is when you have texts that kind of link to each other, so it gets confusing about where one text ends and another one begins. Lovecraft famously did this because he would make up, Cthulhu and Hastor and all these demonic elder gods. And then he would get his friends to include those gods too, and he would edit people's short stories and he would add those in as well. And so if you keep reading all this, you think, well, is Cthulhu real? Everybody's talking about him, right? Maybe. And this is way before, you can go on Snopes or something and find out for yourself, right? And so The Exorcist did something very similar, right? There's a movie, there's a novel, and both these things are saying we're based on a true story. And so there were surveys from the 70s where lots of people said on the survey that The Exorcist is real. And assume that this basically was essentially a true story.
The Exorcist fits. It seems to me that it seems more biblically sound, or maybe it's hewing closer to actual thought about exorcism at the time. But now it's like exorcism has become such a common trope, probably as a result of the Exorcist film. But it seems to be anchored in I don't want to not say reality, but at least in Catholic fact, maybe to some extent. But The Omen makes stuff up wholesale. Like it invents Bible verses. It's wildly inaccurate, and yet it's also one of these core. It's one of the three legs of your stool of this unholy trinity. You want to talk about the sort of fictional Bible verses and how they've impacted people's thoughts on the Antichrist?
Yeah, so The Exorcist is kind of a Catholic answer to Rosemary's Baby. The Omen is kind of a Protestant answer. And the idea for it came from this Protestant producer who said, I want people to know about the dangers of the Antichrist. I want to use a horror movie to do this and to sort of bring people to Jesus. But then he tapped David Seltzer to write the script, and Seltzer was a secular Jew and really initially said he didn't want to do it because he said the devil is not real and I'm not going to really learn anything reading about what he regarded as a mythological character. But he ends up writing a script, and he actually even wrote a novel that came out at about the same time, because in that era, all horror movies had novels tied to them. And he just made up verses from Revelation that are simply not there in the book. And if you have any biblical literacy at all, you know the book of Revelation is not written in rhyme. It doesn't sound like Dr. Seuss, but we also know that there's a weird paradox in America where Americans love the Bible, right? And politicians can just hold up a Bible and people will vote for them.
Even upside down. Yep.
Even upside down, right? But Americans are pretty much ignorant of the contents of the Bible. Many Americans cannot name the four Gospels, let alone other books from the New Testament. And so lots of people just assume that this was real. And so this kind of really bizarre, unbiblical, unhistorical version of the Antichrist mythology really blew up and became a sort of normal. So the omen really did influence how a lot of people thought about, Christianity.
That's amazing. So with these reactions to these films, the shock and disgust and fear, what is it that appeals to people about these films and to this day as well?
Eric,
lasting appeal.
Well, I mean, it kind of depends on what type of lasting appeal you're talking about. A lot of the things that we study when we talk about folks that are very religious and that have these sort of ideas about good and evil and believe that there are in fact demons and whatnot, they get a sort of confirmation from these movies. These movies show them that, yes, my worldview is correct. I'm not wrong. There are bad things. The stuff that is happening right now on this screen, this is real. It just told me that this is based on a true story. So there are demons, and my belief system is valid. It's grounded in a reality. You know, that's in addition to, of course, the normal things that people love about horror films, the kind of, safe space to be scared and these other kind of things. But when it comes to the religious aspects of it, I think that they also give them not just the opportunity to sort of experience a little bit of that that demonic, if you're a Christian, angle, but it also gives them that, as I said, it gives them that veracity in their belief, and they like to. It makes them feel as if they know what they're doing.
I can see that.
Yeah, and we interviewed the Hayes brothers who did the Conjuring movies, and they said, we don't make horror movies; we make religious supernatural movies, and they were pretty clear that we want people to bring everyone from their church to see our movies, ideally once a year. So there was a real attempt to get the religious market as well as horror fans watching these films.
You talk about Michael Barkun's concept of conspiratorial fact fiction reversal, and you give a specific example of Rosemary's Baby, wherein someone claimed that it wasn't necessarily that it was literally real events, but that it was camouflaging actual events. Would you like to talk a little bit about that and how that works?
Sure. So people know the difference between movies and real life, but if you have a kind of conspiratorial mindset, people kind of do a sort of mental gymnastics to say the movie is real. Michael Barkun studies conspiracy theories. And so if you study kind of UFO conspiracy theories, there are, people who claim, when E.T. and Close Encounters came out, the government had a good relationship with these aliens, and they were getting technology, and they were letting people, letting the aliens abduct people and mutilate cattle. But then things started to go south. The government didn't trust the aliens as much. So then they made Independence Day. And so if you want to know what's actually happening in the kind of secret conspiracy world vis-a-vis the aliens, you got to watch all the movies coming out of Hollywood. With Rosemary's Baby, Dwight York, who led a black new religious movement called the Nuwabian Nation, claimed that this was a real event, that this was sort of describing the birth of the Antichrist, and that the sort of Illuminati or the Satanists or whoever who control Hollywood released it in fictional form. So we would say, even though it's a fictional movie, it's not really fiction because Hollywood is run by this conspiracy.
And further, they're laughing at us by putting this out there. They are showing us in no uncertain terms who and what they are, but cloaked in this, you know, fiction. So we don't necessarily see the real impact of it.
I just want to quickly mention that when I was reading the book, you were talking about this whole fact fiction reversal and talking about this idea that sometimes fiction is said to be hiding real truths. It reminded me of an older case that still affects us today, and that's the how Madame Blavatsky, the Theosophist, really got hung up on this Bulwer Lytton book, The Coming Race. And I feel like we're really still sort of living in the world where Theosophy and its ideas about race are unfortunately still with us, even though most people don't know what Theosophy is and don't know about root races other than through sort of Nazi literature and Nazi thought. But it does have a sort of weirder spiritual past beyond that.
Yeah, this Twin Flames documentary that's on Netflix right now, that's a theosophical concept.
Whoa, no, I don't know about this. What's this? Twin Flames, I got to write it down. I got to look it up.
So Twin Flame is just the idea that you have basically a soulmate, right? And this was a group that formed over Zoom, and they said, we'll help you find your twin flame.
At last, technology can solve what reality couldn't. What?
That's right, but it became very toxic, right? Because they wanted you to find your twin flame right away, including if, you know, you had if you were a woman and you had a gay friend that you had dinner with sometimes, they say, that's it, that's your twin flame.
And so, well,
in the documentary, people are getting restraining orders and they're getting, you know, arrested for stalking and things like this. It turns into a pretty toxic group pretty quickly. But the idea is originally a theosophical one.
I think we should wrap up this part of the discussion, but I just had one final question I wanted to ask. I had to ask about the guy who sued for breaking his tooth when he watched The Exorcist. Did he win or did he lose the case?
Gosh, yeah, I think that he lost, but this also happened with the War of the Worlds broadcast. Somebody sued following the War of the Worlds broadcast and said there was a rioting, and in the rioting and confusion, I lost my shoes. And I think in that case, Orson Welles just mailed the guy a new pair of shoes and called it a day. But
there you go. Yeah.
there is precedent from you made Scary Entertainment too well, and now you have to compensate me.
That was my soul loss.
Oh, nice tie-in.
yeah, okay. So we're talking with Joe Laycock and Eric Harrelson about their new book, The Exorcist Effect, and its overall premise about how fiction impacts the way people actually experience life and how that in turn feeds back into fiction. And we'll be back in part two next week.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard part one of our two-part interview with Eric Harrelson and Joseph Laycock discussing their new book, The Exorcist Effect. There's a link in the show notes to the book, but you can find it at Amazon or quality bookshops near you. As a reminder, on December 15th, there will be a signing of this book at the Glass Coffin Boutique. That's 3009 North Interstate Highway 35, Austin, Texas. That'll be in the show notes. And on December 17th, there will be a signing at Curio Arcanum, and that's at 5924 South Congress Avenue, Unit 23, Austin, Texas. Again, all that detail will be in the show notes as well. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones. And we love Kindle, so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all,
you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk's theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. You know, I thought about maybe changing the theme out with a little piece that I wrote myself, but then I realized
that's much too vulgar a display of power.
Been a Monster House presentation.